You're listening to the audio production of Girl, Wash Your Face. Stop believing the lies about who you are so you can become who you were meant to be. By Rachel Hollis. Published by Thomas Nelson. And read by the author. For Jen, who has shaken my worldview off its axis 3 times. Once with Interrupted. Once with a trip to Ethiopia. And lastly, by teaching us all that a real leader speaks the truth, even to her own detriment. Introduction. Hey girl, hey. This is the big opening letter to my book, the part where I tell you all the things I'm hoping for as you read it. This is the moment where I outline my intentions, and if you're already game to read on, this is where I fire you up more about what to anticipate. This is also the important letter for someone standing in the bookstore right now trying to decide if she should buy this book or like the life-changing magic of tidying up. And the words she's reading now will decide for her. I mean, that feels like a lot of pressure for one little letter, but here we go. This book is about a bunch of hurtful lies and one important truth. The truth? You, and only you, are ultimately responsible for who you become and how happy you are. That's the takeaway. Don't get me wrong. I'm going to tell you 100 stories that are funny or weird or embarrassing or sad or crazy, but each of them is reaching for this same pithy, Pinterest-worthy truth. Your life is up to you. But that truth will never be believable if you don't first understand the lies that get in the way of it. Understanding that you choose your own happiness, that you have control of your own life, is so important. It's one of those things we grasp with both hands and put up on the bulletin board as a reminder. But it's not the only thing you need to understand. You also need to identify and systematically destroy every lie you've told yourself your whole life. Why? Because it's impossible to go somewhere new, to become something new, without first acknowledging where you are. The self-awareness that comes from truly digging into what you've come to believe about who you are is invaluable. Have you ever believed that you aren't good enough? That you're not thin enough? That you're unlovable? That you're a bad mom? Have you ever believed that you deserve to be treated badly? That you'll never amount to anything? All lies. All lies perpetuated by society, the media, our family of origin, or frankly, and this is my Pentecostal showing, by the devil himself. These lies are dangerous and devastating to our sense of worth and our ability to function. The most sinister thing about them is that we rarely hear them at all. We rarely hear the lies we've created about ourselves because they've been playing so loudly in our ears for so long that they've become white noise. The hateful narrative bombards us every day, yet we don't even realize it's there. Recognizing the lies we've come to accept about ourselves is the key to growing into a better version of ourselves. If we can identify the core of our struggles while simultaneously understanding that we are truly in control of conquering them, then we can utterly change our trajectory. That's why I do what I do. That's why I run a website and talk about how to make a centerpiece or parent with kindness or strengthen a marriage. It's why I research 30 different ways to clean out your front load washer before I taught my tribe how to do it. It's why I know the perfect ratio of balsamic and citrus to make your pot roast taste amazing. Sure, I cover a whole host of topics using my online platform, but ultimately they boil down to one thing. These are the elements of my life, and I want to do them well. The posts demonstrate how I am growing and learning, and I want them to grow and encourage other women too. I suppose if I'd been into homeschooling or knitting or photography or macrame, I would have used those things to try and better myself and boost up my friends. But I'm not into those things. I'm into lifestyle stuff. So I focus on creating content that falls under the banner of lifestyle media. Early on in this career, though, I realized that a lot of women look at lifestyle imagery as what they should aspire to be. Many of those images are impossible, another lie foisted upon us. So I set out to be honest from the beginning. I vowed to be authentic and sincere, and for every gloriously styled cupcake picture we produced, I shared a photo of myself with facial paralysis. If I went somewhere fancy like the Oscars, I balanced that with a post about my struggle with weight loss and pictures of me 40 pounds heavier. I've talked about it all. Struggles in my marriage, postpartum depression, and feeling jealous, scared, angry, ugly, unworthy, unloved. I have tried to be totally real about who I am and where I'm coming from. Seriously, the most famous thing I've ever done was to post a picture of my stretch marks on my saggy tummy on the internet. And yet I still get the notes. Women from all over the world still email and ask me how I manage to keep it all together while they struggle. I can feel the pain in those emails. I can hear the shame in the words they use to describe their own hardships, and it makes my heart hurt. So I write them back. I tell every single one how beautiful and strong she is. I call them warrior, courageous, fighter. I tell them not to give up. It's what feels appropriate to say to a total stranger. But it's not all I want to say. It's not what I would say if it was my sister who was hurting or my best friend. It's not what I wish I could say to my younger self. Because to those closest to me, I am supportive and encouraging, but I absolutely refuse to watch you wallow. The truth is that you are strong and courageous and a fighter. But if I'm telling you that, it's because I want you to see those characteristics in yourself. I want to grab you by the shoulders and shake you until your teeth rattle. I want to get in your face until you have the courage to look me in the eyes and see the answer for yourself. I want to shout at the top of my lungs until you know this one great truth. You are in control of your own life. You get one and only one chance to live, and life is passing you by. Stop beating yourself up, and dang it, stop letting others do it too. Stop accepting less than you deserve. Stop buying things you can't afford to impress people you don't even really like. Stop eating your feelings instead of working through them. Stop buying your kids' love with food or toys or friendship because it's easier than parenting. Stop abusing your body and your mind. Stop. Just get off the never-ending track. Your life is supposed to be a journey from one unique place to another. It's not supposed to be a merry-go-round that brings you back to the same spot over and over again. Your life doesn't have to look like mine. Heck, your life doesn't have to look like anyone else's at all, but it should at least be a creation of your own making. Is it going to be hard? Absolutely. But taking the easy way out is how you end up on the sofa, 50 pounds overweight, while life passes you by. Will change happen overnight? No way. This is a lifelong process. You'll try out some different tools and techniques, and while some of them will feel okay, maybe one will feel like the answer, and then 37 different others will feel like garbage. Then you'll wake up tomorrow and do it again, and again, and again, and you'll fail. You'll fall off the wagon. You'll eat half of a birthday cake when no one is watching, or scream at your husband, or drink too much wine all month long. You'll fall into ruts because this is life and that's just how it goes. But once you understand that you are the one who is truly in control, you'll get up and try again. And you'll keep going until being in control feels more natural than being out of control. It'll become a way of life, and you'll become the person you are meant to be. It's worth asking right here, right up front, where faith plays a role in all of this. As a Christian, I grew up learning that God was in control, that God had a plan for my life, and I believe in the marrow of my bones that this is true. I believe God loves each of us unconditionally, but I don't think that means we get to squander the gifts and talents He's given us simply because we're good enough already. A caterpillar is awesome. But if the caterpillar stopped there, if she just decided that good is good enough, we would all miss out on the beautiful creature she would become. You are more than you have become. That's what I want to tell the women who write to me asking for advice. It might be tough to hear, but that knowledge is followed by this sweet truth. You are more than you have become, and you are utterly in control over what you do with that knowledge. Which led me to an idea. What if I wrote a whole book about all the ways I have struggled and then explained the steps that helped me get past those times? What if I talked about all of my failures and embarrassing moments? What if you knew that my biggest shame is that I sometimes get so angry I scream at my children? Not holler, not yell, not scold them strongly, but scream so loudly it nauseates me to think of it later. What if you hear that I likely have at least 3 cavities in my mouth right now because I'm petrified of the dentist? What if I talked about my cellulite or the weird third boob thing that sits between my arm and my regular boob when I wear a tank top? Did I mention back fat or the hair that grows out of the mole on my face or my insecurities? What if I started a book by telling you that I peed my pants as an adult, as a fully grown human, and it wasn't the first time, nor will it be the last? And what if I told you that even in spite of my confessions, be they funny, embarrassing, painful, or gross, that I am at peace with myself, that I love who I am even when I do things I'm not proud of? And that it's possible because I know I am ultimately in control of making change. I am in control over the person I will become. By the grace of God, I will wake up tomorrow and have another chance to do this life better. By the grace of God, I've had 35 years of trying so hard in some areas of my life, like the creation of cheese-based casseroles, that I'm crushing it. And in other areas, like controlling my anxiety, I am constantly working on different angles to attack the same problem. It's a lifelong journey, but I rest in the knowledge that every day I'm learning and growing, which lets me feel at peace with myself. The things I've struggled with, the lies I've believed about myself for so long, the list is a mile long. So long, in fact, that I decided to dedicate a chapter to each one. Every single section of this book begins with a lie that I believed, and what follows are the stories of how that particular lie held me back, hurt me, and in some cases, caused me to hurt others. But by admitting to these lies, I have taken their power away. I'll share with you how I made changes in my life to overcome the struggles, some for good and some as an ever-evolving dance between myself and lifelong insecurities. What are my insecurities? Well, here are some of the biggest and the baddest in no particular order. I hope they'll encourage you. I hope you'll find the ideas helpful. More than anything, I hope you'll rest in the knowledge that you can become whoever and whatever you want to be, my sweet friend. And on the days that seem the hardest, you'll remember that by an inch or a mile, forward momentum is the only requirement. Love, Rach. Chapter 1. The Lie. Something else will make me happy. I peed my pants last week. Not full-on peed my pants like that one time at summer camp when I was 10 years old. We were playing Capture the Flag, and I couldn't hold it a second longer. I didn't want to admit that I'd just wet my pants, so I doused myself with a bottle of water. Imagine, if you will, that once all of my clothes were wet, no one, most especially Christian Clark, my camp crush, was the wiser. I was resourceful even then. Did others find it odd that I was suddenly soaking wet? Probably. But I'd rather be an oddball than a pants wetter any day of the week. As for last week, this wasn't that level of peeing my pants. This was just your regular, I've pushed three babies out of my body, dribbling. Giving birth to a baby is like a space shuttle launch. Everything gets destroyed on the way out, which means that sometimes, you guys, I pee my pants. If this knowledge hurts your tender sensibilities, then I'm going to assume you haven't had bladder control problems, and I offer you my congratulations. However, if my experience makes sense to you, then you probably have this problem too, which means you just laughed a little, having experienced a similar predicament. I was jumping with my boys out back, and somebody hollered for me to show off a mid-air toe touch. This is my only known skill on a trampoline, and if I'm going to work up the gumption to hoist myself onto that spring-loaded death trap, you'd better believe I'm going to give it my all. One second, I was soaring through the air like one of those extra tiny gals they launch into basket tosses during a cheerleading competition. And in the next moment, my pants were wet. Nobody noticed, unless you count my pride, but it happened just the same. I had to keep jumping so that the continuous wind rush would dry out my shorts. I'm resourceful, remember? The timing was perfection, too, because not 30 minutes later, a previously programmed Facebook post went up showing me trying on dresses for the Oscars. Before you get the wrong impression, I am not fancy enough to go to the Academy Awards. I am, however, married to someone ultra hunky. He's not really fancy either, but his job certainly is. That means that sometimes I get to wear dresses like a princess and drink free wine in well-lit ballrooms. In these instances, photos show up on Instagram or Facebook of us looking well-coiffed and ultra-glam, and the internet goes wild. This is prime real estate for people to write me notes about how glamorous my life is, how stylish and fashionable and perfect my world must be. And all I can think when I read those comments later is, I've just peed myself in public, surrounded by other human beings. I've literally gone to the bathroom in the air while trying to force my hamstrings into unnatural gymnastics positions in order to impress my three-year-old. Y'all, I'm about as unglamorous as you can get. And I don't mean that in a celebrity, stars are just like us kind of way. This is not like that time that Gwyneth went makeup-free and with her perfect skin and her angel blonde hair tried to convince us that she was just a regular gal even in her $400 t-shirt. No, I mean this literally. I am not glamorous. I am 1,000% one of the nerdiest people you're likely to meet. If I've somehow managed to convince you otherwise because I run a lifestyle website with pretty pictures, or because my hair looks extra shiny on Instagram sometimes, well, sister, let me set you straight. I am not a perfect wife, not a perfect mother, not a perfect friend or boss, and most definitely not a perfect Christian. Not even close. I am not perfect at anything I do. Well, except for making and eating dishes that are primarily cheese-based. But the other stuff, the life stuff, oh girl, I'm struggling. I feel like it's important to say that. Important enough to base an entire book around the idea, in fact, because I want to make sure you hear it. I am so incredibly flawed in big ways and small ways and sideways and beside ways, and I make a living telling other women how to better their lives. Me, of the workout regimens and DIY skin brightening scrub. Me, with tips on cooking Thanksgiving dinner and the itemized list of how to parent your kids. Me, I am failing all the time. This is important because I want you to understand, my sweet, precious friend, that we're all falling short. Yet even though I fail over and over and over again, I don't let it deter me. I still wake up every day and try again to become a better version of myself. Some days, I feel as if I'm getting closer to the best version of me. Other days, I eat cream cheese for dinner. But the gift of life is that we get another chance tomorrow. Somewhere along the way, women got the wrong information. Or I should say, we got so much of the wrong information that we washed our hands of the whole thing. We live in an all-or-nothing society that says I need to look, act, think, and speak perfectly, or just throw in the towel and stop trying altogether. That's what I worry about the most, that you've stopped trying. I get the notes from readers and see thousands of comments on my social media feeds. Some of you feel so overwhelmed by your life that you've given up. You're a piece of jetsam being tugged along with the tide. It feels too hard to keep up with the game, so you've quit playing. Oh, sure, you're still here. You still show up for work, you still make dinner and take care of your kids, but you're always playing catch-up. You always feel behind and overwhelmed. Life is not supposed to overwhelm you at all times. Life isn't meant to be merely survived, it's meant to be lived. Seasons or instances will inevitably feel out of your control. But the moments when you feel like you're drowning are supposed to be brief. They should not be the whole of your existence. The precious life you've been given is like a ship navigating its way across the ocean, and you're meant to be the captain of the vessel. Certainly, there are times when storms toss you around or cover the deck with water or break the mast clean in half. But that's when you need to fight your way back, to throw all the water off the boat bucket by bucket. That's when you need to battle to get yourself back to the helm. This is your life. You are meant to be the hero of your own story. This doesn't mean you become selfish. This doesn't mean you discard your faith or quit believing in something greater than yourself. What it means is taking responsibility for your own life and your own happiness. Said another way, a harsher, more likely to get me punched in the face way, if you're unhappy, that's on you. When I say unhappy, I mean unhappy. I don't mean depressed. True depression has everything to do with your genetic makeup and the chemical balance in your body. As someone who's battled depression personally, I have the utmost compassion for anyone who's going through it. I also don't mean sadness. Sadness or grief brought on by circumstances outside of your control, like the soul-shredding loss of a loved one, is not something that can be walked through quickly or easily. Sadness and pain are things you have to sit with and get to know, or you'll never be able to move on. When I say unhappy, I mean discontented, unsettled, frustrated, angry, any of a number of emotions that make us want to hide from our lives instead of embracing them with arms wide open like a Creed song. Because happy people, the ones who are enjoying their lives 90% of the time, do exist. You've seen them. In fact, you're reading a book written by one right now. Ultimately, I think that's what people are commenting on in my photos. They're saying, your life looks so perfect. But what I think they mean is, your life seems happy. You look content. You're always optimistic and grateful. You're always laughing. I want to explain why. I didn't have an easy start. Actually, if I'm being honest, the word I would use to describe much of my childhood is traumatic. Our house was chaotic. The highest highs and the lowest lows. There were big parties filled with family and friends, followed by screaming and fighting and crying. Fist-sized holes would find their way into the walls, and plates would shatter against the kitchen floor. My father handled stress with anger. My mother handled it by going to bed for weeks at a time. Like most children who grow up similarly, I didn't know there was any other way to be a family. Then, when I was 14 years old, my big brother, Ryan, committed suicide. The things I saw and went through that day will haunt me forever. But they also changed me in a fundamental way. I was the baby of four children and had spent my life up until that point largely ignorant of the world outside my own home. But when Ryan died, our already turbulent and troubled home shattered. If life was difficult before he died, it was untenable afterwards. I grew up in that single day. And amid the anguish and fear and confusion of his death, I recognized a great truth. If I wanted a better life than the one I'd been born into, it was up to me to create it. The year he died, I was a freshman in high school, and I immediately started taking as many classes as I could in order to graduate early. My junior year, I received my diploma and moved to Los Angeles, the closest major city to my small California hometown. To this country mouse, LA seemed like the kind of place where any dream could come true. I was 17 years old, not even grown up enough to get a phone line or sign the lease on my apartment without an adult signature. But all I could focus on was finally getting away. For years, I'd live within the chaos of my childhood home, thinking, someday I'll get out of here, and then I'll be happy. How could I not be happy in LA? I soaked up every inch of it, from the second my feet hit the ground. I absorbed the frenetic energy of Hollywood and adapted to the rhythm of the waves rolling to shore along PCH. A multidimensional skyline made me feel worldly. I appreciated the kind of views that only an outsider would see. Most people don't notice the trees in Beverly Hills. They're much too busy coveting the mansions that sit below them. But the trees were one of the first things I saw. I gloried in the beauty for the sake of beauty, since that sort of thing hadn't existed in the place where I'd grown up. The thing is, the trees all match in Beverly Hills. On any given street, around any given corner, even amid the chaos of a bustling city, you will see row after row of perfect symmetry. A menagerie of Canary Island pines and camphor trees and date palms. They were laid out by the original landscape architect back at the beginning of the 20th century. They hug the wide streets in meticulous rows, silent sentinels of one of the world's most affluent cities. After a lifetime of chaos, I delighted in the order. Finally, I thought to myself, I'm where I belong. Time passed and seasons changed, and my new city eventually taught me one of the most vital lessons I've ever learned. Moving or traveling or getting away, it's just geography. Moving doesn't change who you are. It only changes the view outside your window. You must choose to be happy, grateful, and fulfilled. If you make that choice every single day, regardless of where you are or what's happening, you will be happy. I get to see my best friend Amanda a few times a year. Every time we hang out, we talk until our throats are sore and laugh until our cheeks hurt. Amanda and I would have just as much fun hanging out in my living room as we would lying on a beach in Mexico. Now, granted, Mexico is prettier and the weather is nicer and we'd have easier access to cocktails with little umbrellas in them. But we can have a great time whether we're in my backyard or behind the dumpster at the local Walmart because we're so excited to hang out with each other. When you're engaged and involved and choosing to enjoy your own life, it doesn't matter where you are or, frankly, what negative things get hurled at you. You'll still find happiness because it's not about where you are, but who you are. Things that helped me. 1. I stopped comparing myself. I stopped comparing myself to other people, and I also stopped comparing myself to whoever I thought I was supposed to be. Comparison is the death of joy, and the only person you need to be better than is the one you were yesterday. 2. I surrounded myself with positivity. I cringe even writing that because it sounds like a poster you'd see taped to the wall of your 8th grade gym class. But cheesy or not, it's gospel. You become who you surround yourself with. You become what you consume. If you find yourself in a slump or feel as though you're living in a negative space, take a good hard look at who or what you see every day. 3. I figured out what makes me happy and I do those things. This seems like the most obvious idea in the world, but at the end of the day, very few people intentionally choose the things that bring them joy. No, I don't mean that you can build a life around massages and lavish dinners, or maybe you can, fancy pants. I mean that you should spend more time doing things that feed your spirit, more long walks with your dog, less volunteering for that thing you feel obligated to do but actually hate. You are in charge of your own life, sister, and there's not one thing in it that you're not allowing to be there. Think about it. Chapter 2. The Lie. I'll start tomorrow. I can't count the number of diets I've tried. I can't tell you the number of times I've made plans to go to the gym and then blew them off. Number of half marathons I signed up for, paid the entry fee for, and then quietly pretended not to remember when it was time to actually train. 2. Number of times I've declared, from here on out, I'm going to walk a mile every morning before work, and then never made it past the third day. Infinity. I had this habit for years, as many women do. We talk about the things we'd like to do, be, try, and accomplish, but once we get to the moment of actually doing it, we fold faster than a card table after bunko night. Maybe we've created this habit because we were brought up observing this pattern. Magazines and TV shows spend a lot of time focusing on what to do when we fall off the wagon, rather than teaching us how to stay on it in the first place. Life happens, and the plans we make fall through. But when it becomes such a regular occurrence that the promises we make hold very little actual power in our lives, we need to check ourselves. A few months ago, I was out to dinner with my closest girlfriends. It was an impromptu happy hour that turned into an impromptu dinner and ended up going later than any of us anticipated. I got home after the kids were in bed, and Dave was already deep into a game of Major League Ball or Hard Hitting League or whatever the name is of the baseball game he's played nightly for the last 2 years of our marriage, without making any real progress that I'm aware of. So I gave him a smooch and chatted with him about his day. Then I went downstairs to the basement where our old treadmill is hidden, and I ran a few miles. I put the evidence of that workout on Snapchat. And later, my girlfriend saw it and sent me a text. You worked out after dinner? What in the world? I wrote back, yes, because I planned on doing it and I didn't want to cancel. Couldn't you just postpone it until tomorrow? She was genuinely perplexed. No, because I made a promise to myself and I don't break those. Not ever. Ugh, she typed back. I'm the first person I break a promise to. She's not the only one. I used to do that all the time, until I realized how hard I was fighting to keep my word to other people while quickly canceling on myself. I'll work out tomorrow became, I'm not working out anytime soon. Because honestly, if you really cared about that commitment, you'd do it when you said you would. What if you had a friend who constantly flaked on you? What if every other time you made plans, she decided not to show up? What if she gave lame excuses like, I really want to see you, but this TV show I'm watching is just so good? What if a friend from work was constantly starting something new? Every 3 Mondays, she announced a new diet or goal, and then 2 weeks later, it just ended. What if you called her on it like, hey, Pam, I thought you were doing Whole 30. Meanwhile, Pam is sitting in the break room eating a meat lover's pizza and telling you that she was doing Whole 30, and even though it made her feel great, 2 weeks into the program, her son had a birthday party and she couldn't resist the cake and then figured there was no point. Now she's gained back the pounds she lost plus a few extra. Y'all, would you respect her? This woman who starts and stops over and over again? Would you count on Pam or the friend who keeps blowing you off for stupid reasons? Would you trust them when they committed to something? Would you believe them when they committed to you? No. No way. And that level of distrust and apprehension applies to you too. Your subconscious knows that you, yourself, cannot be trusted after breaking so many plans and giving up on so many goals. On the flip side, have you ever known someone who always kept their word? If they tell you they're coming, you can expect them 10 minutes early. If they commit to a project, you can bet your butt they'll finish it. They tell you they've signed up for their first marathon, and you're already in awe because you know for a fact they'll finish. When this type of person commits to something, how seriously do you take their commitment? I hope you see my point here. If you constantly make and break promises to yourself, you're not making promises at all. You're talking. You're waxing poetic like Pam and her diet or your flaky friend who bails on you to watch Game of Thrones. How many times have you bailed on yourself to watch TV? How many times have you given up before you've even started? How many times have you made real progress only to face a setback and then give up completely? How many times have your friends or family or coworkers watched you quit? How many times have your children watched you give up on yourself over and over and over? This is not okay. Our society makes plenty of room for complacency or laziness. We're rarely surrounded by accountability. We're also rarely surrounded by sugar-free vanilla lattes. But when I really want one, I somehow find a way to get one. I'm only sort of kidding. When you really want something, you'll find a way. When you don't really want something, you'll find an excuse. How does your subconscious know the difference between what you want and what you only pretend to want? It looks at a history of how you've tackled similar things in the past. Have you kept your word? When you set out to do something, did you see it through? When we're at a loss, we reach for the lowest bar. And the lowest bar is typically our highest level of training. That sounds a little backwards, so let me explain. If you set out to run 30 miles today, where do you think you'll easily get to without stopping? You'll get to your highest level of training. So if the most you've ever run comfortably is 4 miles, you'll peter out somewhere around there. Sure, adrenaline can take you a bit further, and mind over matter is a big deal too. But typically, your body will revert to what it knows and what it feels most comfortable with. The same can be said for keeping promises to yourself. If you decide on a goal, for example, I'm going to write a novel, or I'm going to run a 10K, your subconscious will formulate the likelihood of that happening based on past experiences. So when it's day 4 and you're feeling tired and you don't want to head out for the run, you will revert to the highest level of mental training. What happened the last time you found yourself here? Did you push through and form a habit and get it done? Or did you make an excuse? Did you put it off until later? Whatever standard you've set for yourself is where you'll end up, unless you fight through your instinct and change your pattern. That's how I changed my own patterns and behaviors. How I established the rule in my life that I would no longer break a promise to myself, no matter how small it was. And it all began with Diet Coke. I used to love, like obsessively love, Diet Coke. For the longest time, I'd have several Diet Cokes a day. Then I realized how terrible they were for me. I cut my consumption down to 1 can a day. And I looked forward to that soda like an addict waiting for a high. Do I want to drink it at lunchtime to give the afternoon a little pep? Or should I wait until dinner? We're eating Mexican food tonight, and Diet Coke is so good with chips and salsa, so maybe holding out is the right choice. I spent way too much time looking forward to the beverage. Then, one summer, I found myself with terrible vertigo. And I tried cutting anything out of my diet that might be harmful. Even my daily Diet Coke came into question. Honestly, I thought to myself. What kind of sicko gives up Diet Coke? Are we supposed to just give up joy and goodness in our lives? Why don't I give up electricity and live like the Amish? My inner monologues are incredibly dramatic. I decided to give it up for a month. I figured 1 month wasn't a long time. I could hold out for 30 days on anything. The only problem was I never in my life successfully stuck to any kind of diet, exercise, riding, you name it, without quitting or cheating at least a few times. What if just this once, though, I really saw it through? And so I did. For 30 days, I didn't have any soda of any kind, which seems like no big deal when you're healthy and happy and not addicted. For me, the first week was a special kind of hell. But what if, I kept asking myself, what if I just don't break this promise? One day passed and then another, and by week three, it wasn't bad at all. At the end of the month, I hadn't broken my word, and by then, I didn't even crave DC anymore. It's been 4 years now, and it doesn't even occur to me to drink Diet Coke anymore. When faced with it as an option, my instinct is to reach for my training, which tells me that I don't drink that stuff anymore. Establishing success in this one small area made me realize that the one thing standing between me and achieving my goals is the ability to build on past success. Running my first half marathon, I got there by committing to running 1 mile a few times a week. When I kept that promise to myself, committing to running 2 miles a few times a week didn't seem like such a tough thing. My training told me that whatever goal I set, I would keep, even if I was tired. So I kept showing up. Writing my first book, it was the same kind of thing. Before that first completed manuscript, I'd started and stopped at least a dozen different novels. But once I got a first draft, I knew it was something I could do. When my instinct is to give up or walk away or throw my computer against the wall when I'm on deadline, I remember how many times I've been here before. I used to wear the word count of my first novel on a cheap gold bracelet around my wrist. 82,311 was etched into it. And every time I looked at it, I would remember what I'd achieved. I was the one who'd strung 82,311 words together in semi-coherent sentences. When faced with the challenge of writing other books, I revert there. Well, I think, at least I know I can write that many words. I've done it before. I know that blowing off a workout, a date, an afternoon to organize your closet, or some previous commitment to yourself doesn't seem like a big deal. But it is. It's a really big deal. Our words have power, but our actions shape our lives. If you choose today not to break another promise to yourself, you will force yourself to slow down. You cannot keep every commitment, promise, goal, and idea without intentionality. If you recognize that your words have power and that your commitments carry covenant weight, you won't agree to anything so easily. You'll have to ask yourself if you really, truly have time to meet that friend for coffee this week. You'll have to decide if working out 4 times before Sunday is a real possibility, or if it's more realistic and achievable to commit to 2 beast mode sessions and then 1 power walk with your neighbor. You'll slow down and think things through. You won't just talk about a goal. You'll plan for how you can meet it. You'll set a goal and surprise yourself when you achieve it. You'll teach yourself a new way to behave and set a standard for the type of person you truly are. Not the one you've dreamed about becoming, but who you practice being every single day. Also, maybe you'll consider giving up diet soda because the chemicals in that mess are terrible for you. Things that helped me. Number 1, starting with 1 small goal. Diet Coke felt like my great white whale at the time, But in retrospect, giving up a soda was a million times easier than running marathons, hitting our annual budget goals, or writing a book. When someone tells me they want to start a diet, I'll suggest they start by aiming to drink half their body weight in ounces of water every day. It's much easier to add a habit than to take one away, but the water goal is a challenge. When they conquer that for a month, they've set a new standard for achievement and can add on something tougher. Number two, being careful with my commitments. We easily jump on board with anything that sounds good for us. A diet? Of course. Volunteering with church this Saturday? Absolutely. We know these things are important and good, so we say yes, assuming the value of the commitment will motivate us into following through. Unfortunately, that isn't always the case. Slow down your yes. Only commit to things you know you can accomplish because they're incredibly important to you. Otherwise, you set yourself up for continued failure. Number three, being honest with myself. Be honest with yourself about what you're blowing off. A little cancellation here or a bow out there can add up, but only if you refuse to acknowledge your actions. If you take a good hard look at what you've canceled on in the last 30 days, you might be shocked to discover how you're training yourself to behave. Chapter 3. The Lie. I'm not good enough. I am a workaholic, and I don't say that lightly. The words are heavy. The knowledge makes my heart hurt. Though, if I give myself a little grace, then the truth is, I am a recovering workaholic. I am a recovering workaholic, and I say those words with the same trepidation and shame that might exist were I to tell you that I had any other kind of addiction. I looked up the definition just now, even though I've been certain of my diagnosis for a couple of years. My online dictionary app describes workaholic as a person who feels compelled to work excessively. Compelled. That's a pretty strong word, isn't it? I can't be the only one who hears it and immediately thinks of The Exorcist and holy water and a terrified priest. But compelled feels accurate. Like something inside of you that won't take no for an answer. Like something you do without conscious thought. Did I feel compelled to work nonstop? Without question. Even now, I am typing this workaholic chapter at 5:37 in the morning because waking up to get my word count in at 5 o'clock is the only way I can actually manage to write books, run a media company, and raise a family at the same time. I still feel compelled to work until I'm exhausted, physically ill, pissed off at the world, or unable to focus my eyes. But at least, they don't all happen at the same time anymore. I feel like I'm gaining on this problem. Part of the reason I work so much is simple. I love my job. No, I freaking love my job. The people I work with are some of the kindest, coolest, most creative cats you'll ever meet. Each person on my team had to be vetted, and each role had to go through a couple of people before we got it right. Everyone had to be trained and had to train me right back on how to manage them and be a boss. I've spent years building this team. When I walk in and it's running well, when one person is creating the speaker lineup for our next live event, and someone else is taking the prettiest pictures you've ever seen, and the business team is booking new partnerships with some of the biggest brands on the planet, I feel proud. Proud to the very bottom of my toes that I, a high school graduate from the sticks, have put this together. Beyond that, my heart wants to burst because all of these people are working their butts off for my dream. I had this fluffy country mouse idea that we could create a space on the internet that lifts up women from every walk of life, that makes them feel encouraged, that makes them feel like they have friends, that offers them help and advice and does it with positivity at all times. And you know what? It's totally working. When I started blogging, only my mom and a few fiercely loyal aunts read the website. Now, my digital reach is somewhere in the millions and climbing every day. My online tribe is awesome. I admire them, and on most days, I think they admire me too. And I'm proud that I've created a business manifestation of my faith in action. Huzzah! Then I go home. At home, Sawyer is fighting with Ford over who gets which Lego piece. Jackson has a little attitude he picked up from someone at school, and if he rolls his eyes at me one more time, Lord Jesus, I'm going to rip off both his arms and whack him over the head with them. The baby is teething and fussy, and tomorrow is pajama day at preschool, but I'm going to miss it because I have a business trip. Dave and I are ships in the night, and we haven't had a date night in weeks, and yesterday I snapped at him over prepackaged lunches and then sobbed all over my pajamas because I felt like such a jerk. And being a mom is hard work. I struggle with it all the time in 100 different ways. But being at work? Oh man, I have that in the bag. I excel at being at work. I am the Babe Ruth of knocking it out of the park in the lifestyle media sector. So when given the choice between crushing it at the office or barely hanging on at home, I got in the habit of working. Working and working some more. Every time I succeeded in business, I counted it as validation that I was making the right choice. But wait, folks, there's more. You didn't think a major problem like this was caused by only one thing, did you? No way. Nobody's psychosis is one layer deep. I am a Vidalia onion of issues. I've got a cartload of emotional baggage. Let's unpack some. I am the baby of four children. And by the time my parents got around to my childhood, their marriage was deeply in trouble. Even though I was the youngest, I was a very self-sufficient child. And I think the combo of those two things meant that I was largely ignored. Unless I did something good. If I got an A on a test. If I scored a goal in the soccer game. If I got a part in the school play. When I succeeded, I got praise and attention. I felt liked and accepted. But the moment the audience stopped clapping, it all went back to the way it was before. What this taught me as a child and what I carried into adulthood, as I discovered amid a load of therapy, is the belief that in order to be loved, I felt like I needed to produce something. Fast forward to me in my 30s, and you'll see that it's nearly impossible for me to sit still. I am constantly moving and going and rushing through life. The second I achieve one goal, and I mean the second it's accomplished, I immediately think, okay, what next? I struggle to celebrate or enjoy any victory, no matter how big, because I'm always mindful of something bigger I could be doing instead. At work, I'm constantly at it. When I get home, I do dishes and organize cabinets and make a list of to-dos that will be impossible to accomplish in this lifetime or the next. This need to prove my worth, coupled with the fact that I'm good at my career, made me one heck of a workaholic. Yet I had no idea that I was one, or that my work was grievously affecting my health and the happiness of my family. The very first time I had facial paralysis, I was 19 years old. I was on the tail end of the first long, hard year with Dave, and I knew the end was in sight. Not the end of the year, the end of our relationship altogether. He seemed more and more detached, and the long-distance relationship that we were trying so hard to make work just wouldn't. I could feel it coming, just like Phil Collins in that one song with the big drum solo, and I started to get anxious. I handled that anxiety the way I handled every other kind in my life. I doubled down at work. My already full plate became fuller. I wasn't even conscious of what I was trying to do. Maybe I told myself that if I didn't stop to think about something bad happening, then it likely wouldn't. One morning I woke up and noticed that my left eye was blinking half a second slower than my right. I assumed I was tired from work and wondered if I needed glasses. By the afternoon, my tongue started to tingle and then lost feeling completely. I went to the doctor, worried I might be having a stroke. That was the first time I'd ever heard of Bell's palsy. A quick Google search informed me that it was a sometimes temporary paralysis that caused damage to the nerves that control the movement of facial muscles. Within days, I couldn't close my left eye, move my mouth, or feel anything on the left side of my face. I don't know why it's only one side of the face, but I can tell you it only adds to the overall charm. I had to wear an eye patch, which, by the way, is super sexy and basically every 19-year-old girl's dream. Because I couldn't move my lips, my speech was slurred and hard to understand. When I chewed, I had to hold my mouth closed with my fingers for fear that food would fly out and kamikaze to the floor. The nerve damage causes neuralgia, which is also incredibly painful. During that time, I felt so sorry for myself. Even though it was 15 years ago, I remember exactly how I felt when I looked in the mirror and realized how disfigured my face actually was. How I tried, in vain, to put on eyeliner or mascara as if adding makeup would somehow make the paralysis go away. Or how, each time I got the makeup on, I would inevitably cry it right back off. I spent those weeks perpetually worried, weighed down by the doctor's prognosis that this could last a few days or months on end. There was no way to be sure. In retrospect, I never thought of myself as conceited. I never wore makeup or styled my hair until I was an adult. But having Bell's palsy made me hyper aware of the way I looked. I became completely depressed. I only got out of bed to go to work, and as soon as I got back home, I got back under the covers. I never wanted to leave my bed or even answer the phone. On the rare occasion that a friend talked me into leaving my apartment, I was mortified at the way people stared or pitied me when I tried to speak. In the midst of it all, the bullet I had been trying to dodge found its mark. Dave broke up with me. Okay, yes. Breaking up with a girl with a paralyzed face was not his finest moment, and I feel the need to point out that sometimes we do stupid things that hurt our loved ones when we're trying to figure ourselves out. Since the moment we got back together, though, which happened when my face was still broken, by the way, he has been an incredible partner. The point, though, is that I made myself severely ill trying to keep something inevitable from happening. When the palsy finally subsided a month later, I was beyond thankful. Relieved that the worst was behind me, I chalked up the experience to a one-time bout of terrible luck. A few years later, Dave and I decided to take our first trip to Europe. This was back when we were child-free and could just dream up plans like, what if we just went to Europe? With no babies or dogs or real responsibility, we just got ourselves a flight and toured old churches with our passports buried under our clothes for fear the gypsies we had heard about would rob us. God bless us. When we made it to Florence, it was everything I dreamed Italy would be. We ate loads of pasta, walked the cobblestone streets, and made out like it was our part-time job. We spent whole afternoons imagining our future and what we would name our unborn dream children. It was one of the most romantic experiences of my life. By the time we got to Venice a few days later, my tongue had started to go numb. I stood in an Italian hotel room and sobbed because I knew the palsy had come back. Our beautiful vacation was now being marred by the stress of trying to get medical help in another country. As an aside, using my English to Italian translation guidebook to explain to a Venetian pharmacist that I needed an eye patch is still one of the most comical experiences of my life. Also, the eye patch, plus my paralyzed face, meant that we got to the front of every line in customs. Silver lining. Ever the comedians, Dave and I made jokes about the assets of such an illness. For example, I did an amazing Sammy Davis Jr. impersonation. Also, the pirate jokes were endless. Yarr. It wasn't until we arrived in Paris, a lifelong dream destination of mine, that even jokes couldn't lift my spirits. As we walked through the Champ de Mars, I realized the photo I had always dreamed of, me in front of the Eiffel Tower, would forever be a reminder of this illness. As much as I hate to admit it, I've never felt sorrier for myself than in that moment. In that old photograph, which you can Google, by the way, because I am not afraid to share any pic on the internet, apparently, I am standing alone in front of the tower, bundled up for the weather. I'm wearing sunglasses to try and hide the eye patch, and since a smile would have only worked on half my face, I just did nothing at all. When we got back home, the doctor put me on steroids and sent me to see a neurologist to make sure the palsy wasn't a symptom of something greater. After the doctors didn't find the brain tumor I was sure was there, they gave me an interesting prognosis. Both times I'd gotten palsy, I'd been under extreme stress. Like many women, I was working so hard and not taking good care of myself. I argued that this couldn't be the case. After all, I'd gotten sick again while on a romantic vacation. That's when Dave pointed out that it was the first vacation we'd taken in 3 years. 3 years of 60-hour weeks followed by 1 2-week break does not a decompressed girl make. I was also at the beginning of launching a business, and I was staying busy, desperate to prove myself. We were trying to get pregnant at the time, and though I was only 24, month after month after month had passed without a baby. Rather than managing that stress, I had just given myself more things to do. Our bodies are incredible. They can do unbelievable things. They will also tell you exactly what they need if you're willing to listen. And if you're not, if you try to do too many things without rest, they will absolutely shut down to get what they need. About 3 years ago, I started to develop symptoms of vertigo. I'd stand up at work and the room would sway around me. I felt dizzy throughout the day. My eyes had trouble focusing, and I spent most of my time feeling nauseous. For weeks, I assumed I must need more sleep, more water, or less Diet Coke. When it got so bad I was afraid to drive with my kids in the car, I decided to see a doctor. I saw so many doctors. Internists, allergists, ENTs, nobody could quite figure it out. I ate well, I was healthy, I ran marathons for goodness sake. They all agreed I had vertigo but couldn't definitively tell me why. Eventually, the ENT suggested it was seasonal vertigo brought on by my allergies, and since no one else had a better idea, I went with it. Take an allergy pill every day, he told me. So I did. Every night, without fail, I took my pill. Sometimes, when the spinning got really bad, I took a second one, which made me crazy drowsy, but at least it calmed the vertigo. I did this for over a year, and resigned myself to the fact that life would be a little dizzier forever. It wasn't a big deal, I told myself. It only meant that instead of giving 100%, I now would need to give 130% to make up for not being able to work as fast anymore. It sounds crazy to write that, but in my overachieving mind, it made absolute sense. Then, about 2 years ago, I heard about a homeopathic doctor who specialized in vertigo. I'd never gone to a homeopathic doctor in my life. But at that point, if someone had said I could cure my constant nausea with voodoo and the sacrifice of a spring chicken, I would have seriously considered it. I went to meet with him, his ponytail, his shirt made of organic hemp, and his life-size statue of Ganesh, and I tried to keep an open mind while he talked into the air beside him instead of to me. I laid out the whole story of when I got sick and how it affected me, and he asked me 100 questions about my emotions, my childhood, and the deeper reasons why I felt a certain way. I kept thinking, when is he going to prescribe some medicine? Why are we still talking about stress, and what's the deal with that little collection of crystals? Before I'd gone to him, I assumed homeopathic doctors tell you to stop your sugar intake or, God forbid, stop eating dairy because it messes with your chakras or whatever. But after 2 hours of me talking, he abruptly interrupted and announced to the room, "No more! I know what's wrong." Then he blew me away. He pointed out that my vertigo had come on for the first time when I was under extreme stress at work. And every time it got so bad that I couldn't lift my head off a pillow, it was because the stress had gotten worse. That time I had a big turnover of staff at Chic? Vertigo. That time I was so excited to write my first contracted book, but then was positive it was terrible and I'd be fired and have to pay back the advance? Vertigo. In every single instance, my vertigo was a physical response to an emotional problem. A physical response to an emotional problem. I didn't even know our bodies did that. Okay, I knew it in the same way that every other God-fearing, law-abiding woman who watched Oprah and heard about self-care knows it. But I grew up in the country. I got a shotgun for my 13th birthday. I may have lived in LA for 14 years, but my rub some dirt on it tendencies run deep. His words hit me like ice water. And now that I knew he was right, I immediately wanted to know how to fix it and get back to normal. Go home and do nothing, he told me. I'm sorry, what? Go home and do nothing. Sit around, watch TV, spend an entire day on the sofa, discover that your world doesn't implode without you going 100 miles an hour, get up the next day and do it again. Verily I say unto you, dear reader, his words made me want to throw up. It sounds crazy. It is kind of crazy. But the idea of doing nothing makes my skin crawl. Even when I'm at home, I'm constantly doing something. If I'm not taking care of the kids, I'm organizing the house, cleaning out my closet, or giving myself a DIY facial. What would happen if you stopped moving? He asked me. I shook my head in blind panic. The image of a shark floating to the surface of the ocean, dead from lack of movement, came to my mind. All I could think was, I don't know, but it will be bad. Talk about life-altering moments. Talk about someone holding a mirror up to your face and making you realize you're not actually the person you think you are at all. I spent my days thinking up ways to help women live a better life. And the whole time, I truly believed I was qualified to teach it because I was actually living it. Meanwhile, I wasn't doing the most fundamental thing a woman needs to do before she can take care of anyone else. Take care of herself. I needed a drastic life change. I forced myself to stop working so many hours. I went to the office from 9:30 to 4:30 and was shocked to discover that the world continued to spin on its axis. I pushed myself to rest, to sit and do nothing. It gave me massive anxiety, so I poured myself a glass of wine and I kept right on sitting there. I started volunteering at the local homeless shelter. I took a hip-hop dance class. Turns out, I'm terrible at hip-hop dance class, but I love it so much, I laugh like a toddler through the entire hour-long process. I looked for joy. I looked for peace. I stopped drinking so much caffeine. I played with my kids. I did a lot of therapy. And then I did some more. I prayed. I looked up every scripture in the Bible that talks about rest. I had dinner with my girlfriends. I went on dates with my husband. I taught myself to take it one day at a time, to stop obsessing over the next victory, and to appreciate the simple parts of today. I learned to celebrate accomplishments, not with big, flashy parties, but with taco nights or a great bottle of wine. I acknowledged my own hard work and the achievements of my company, and I learned to rest in the knowledge that I will still be okay even if both of those things go away tomorrow. I studied the gospel and finally grasped the divine knowledge that I am loved and worthy and enough as I am. Learning to rest is an ongoing process. Like any other lifelong behavior, I constantly fight the desire to slip back into the role I've played for so long. They say the first step is admitting you have a problem. And 2 years ago, I did just that. I learned that I am a recovering workaholic, but through this process, I also learned that I am a child of God. And that trumps everything else. Things that helped me. Number one, I went to therapy. This could be the first thing I list out for every single element I've worked through, but it's especially real in this case. Were it not for my therapist, I never would have understood the connection between my childhood insecurities and my adult accomplishments. Were it not for my therapist, I never would have realized that the drive for accomplishment can actually be harmful. I cannot recommend therapy enough, and if I had Beyoncé's money, the first thing I'd do is pay for therapy for every woman I could find. Ask your friends to recommend someone they like, or ask your gynecologist to refer you. A doctor for your lady parts knows the right kind of counselors for a woman. Trust me. Number two, I hustled for joy. Work just as hard for fun moments, vacation moments, and pee your pants laughing moments as you do for all the other things. I encourage you to take a walk, call a friend, have a glass of wine, enjoy a bubble bath, or take a long lunch. All of that work will be there when you get back, and a little time away can recharge your batteries and give you the energy to battle that ever-growing to-do list. Number three, I reordered my list. When I ask most women to name the things on their priority list, they can throw them out there no problem. Kids, partner, work, faith, etc. The order may change, but the bullet points rarely do. You know what also rarely changes no matter how many women I talk to? Them actually putting themselves on their own priority list. You should be the very first of your priorities. Are you getting enough sleep, enough water, the right nutrition? You cannot take care of others well if you're not first taking care of yourself. Also, one of the best ways to ensure that you stop trying to run from your problems is to face them head on.